My name is Philip Liming. I live on Charlotte Street here in South Hyde Park.
When you're buying a house, you have to act fast, which is stressful because it's a huge decision. Learning the history of your dream house takes time, but it might reveal surprising information. It certainly has for Phil and Amanda.
And actually, we're looking at this house to rent, which is now my next door neighbor. We were looking at to rent that house, decided we didn't like it too much, but we saw a for sale sign in this yard. They happened to be inside cleaning up, you know, just like sweeping. And they said, sure, come on in, you can take a look at the house. And we really liked the house. Well, I noticed that the address is double jumped. There's an obvious space in between. When you look at the rest of the block, there's like an obvious lot missing. And so right when I got home, since I liked the house and I was interested in it, I Googled the missing address that would have been in between. I'm 11, my neighbor's 19, that means 15 would be missing. Well, when you Google that address, immediately up pops Bopperdella.
That's right, the Bob Berdella, the infamous serial killer from the 1980s. The house where he did unspeakable things has been torn down. That's what explains the missing address. It also explains the really big lot Phil and Amanda now enjoy. That's where they keep their bee colony. I'm Gina Kaufman. Even though most houses won't have a shocking serial killer in their past, every house does tell a story. Do you know yours? Share it now. Call 816-235-2888 to tell us what sparked your curiosity and whether you've been able to find answers. We want to hear all about it at 816-235-2888. Now let's meet our guests. Lucinda Adams has helped hundreds of Kansas Cityans learn the history of their houses. She's the Associate Director of Research at the Kansas City branch of the Missouri State Historical Society. Hi, Lucinda.
Hello.
So we're also joined by Jeremy Druin from the Missouri Valley Room at the Kansas City Public Library. Hi, Jeremy.
Hello.
What tends to inspire people to do extensive research on the history of their homes?
I think for most people, for me especially, is finding about your place in your community and how you fit into that community, and knowing the past will help that.
What are your thoughts about that, Jeremy?
We see a lot of people come into the library for a lot of different reasons to explore the history of their house. It could be they want to find the original construction date, architect, the style of their house.
Why do people want to know that stuff? I mean...
Well, I believe because people fall in love with their houses. They're a huge expense. They live there, and they really fall in love with them for a reason. And I think they're curious to know why other people who lived in that house, what kind of history they brought to that house. Why did they love that house? Or maybe there's some unique features of the house. They want to find clues to get to the bottom of it, of why a house may have some unique features.
Your relationship with your house is so intimate, and I wonder if that's part of it. Just, it feels like your relationship is special, and then you realize that someone else walked these same halls, ate breakfast in this same kitchen, you know, maybe raised a family here like you're doing. I mean, who knows? But that maybe it's the intimacy that makes you feel like you share something with past inhabitants?
Oh, yes, definitely. And they want to, you know, they want to share that history. So, and they want to, and sometimes they want to promote that history within their house. We see a lot of people looking for photographs or old maps that they can display. So it's not enough to really know the history, but they want to document it and even display it at their home.
The story we just heard is probably pretty unusual. What are some examples of the kinds of things people are often excited to discover?
I think one of the most exciting things for people is just to find out who lived in the house. What was their profession? Jeremy and I help a lot of different people using city directories to find that types of information. City directory is a great resource. It's kind of like an old phone book. And you can do a reverse lookup through your address, and sometimes it'll list the profession of a person that inhabited that house.
Do city directories, I mean, do those still exist and document where people live today?
They do.
Weird.
You can find them at the library. You can find them at State Historical Society.
What kind of information is super readily available, and then what kinds of questions tend to require more digging?
For us at State Historical Society, it's some stuff that requires a little bit more digging is definitely with architectural drawings. They're very hard to come by. A lot of times they weren't saved if it wasn't a notable architect, a notable builder. So that's a little bit trickier. We have about 18,000 plans in our collection. I think easy to find information will be things in city directories. I know Jeremy can talk about the tax assessment photos.
Tell us about those.
So the photos are one of my favorite collection at the library. I'll give you the quick version. In the post-Pendergast years, 1939, after the fall of Pendergast, there was the local officials identified a need for a honest survey and property assessment of properties in Kansas City and Jackson County. So they the WPA and local officials sent out teams of photographers to scour the city and document every home, business, resident in Jackson County and Kansas City. And they used those for many years. And so we had a photograph of every building in Jackson County. Unfortunately, a lot of those were lost over time. But what we have left is a good portion of Kansas City. It was salvaged by preservationist Jane Flynn in the 1970s. And now we have, with the Landmarks Commission, now the library has those images, and we have some 40,000 to 50,000 photos of Kansas City businesses, homes.
Do you ever
landmarks.
Just get super distracted by that? Like, just start thumbing through it, like, ooh.
Yes, you get very distracted. What's also great about these images too is you get to see people on front porches and streetcars go by and horses, delivery vehicles. It's really more than just a snapshot of the individual home or a downtown building, but really a street scene and a snapshot of life in 1940 Kansas City.
Do you have a favorite of these photos?
that's a hard one. One of my favorite series of photos is, it's a very simple one, and I can't, for life of me, I can't remember the neighborhood, but they went house to house and captured, you know, each residence. And there's a series of photos where there are these little boys in wagons, and you can see them in every frame for about three frames. So as these men were capturing these homes in this neighborhood, these boys were following them. And you could also see people on the front porches kind of looking at them skeptically, kind of scowling or just curious about why these people were in front of their house holding up a sign and being photographed.
Well, let's start hearing our listeners' stories. Jeremy and Lucinda will be here to talk to you about the history of your house or whatever building you happen to live in when you call 816-235-2888. We've got Angela in Midtown on the line. Hi, Angela.
Hi, you can call me Angie.
Okay. Hey, Angie.
Do you just want me to tell a story?
Yeah, please.
Okay, so we bought this building, our building, in 2010, and then a few years after our neighbors actually had stumbled across one of those tax assessment photos. And in it, you can see the very top of our building and the old painted sign with Kent Hinkle's French Laundry. And so then my whole workday was ruined. I went down the rabbit hole. And we found out that Kate Hinkle was a widow, and she was bored and also hated to see lace get thrown out, because back then in the 1920s, if you couldn't afford to send it to the East Coast to be laundered, they would just throw them out.
Anything made of lace?
Yeah, like lacy, those like things that needed like a special way to clean them, they, like table linens and things that were, I guess, fancier. So she bought a couple of tubs, I think, for like $8, and started the business in her home. And eventually it got really popular, and she had our building built. And she built an apartment upstairs, lived upstairs, and she, I think at the height, employed 30 women and had 2 delivery trucks. And then she eventually did die upstairs.
Whoa. So what does knowing this story mean to you now that, you know, this is your building? And
We love it because I feel like it's got to be rare that a woman entrepreneur would, you know, have this building. And we run, you know, my sister and I run our business out of the first floor. And we always wondered, you know, there's these big drains in the first floor. We always wondered why. Now we know.
And so you feel connected to, as women who are entrepreneurs, to this other woman who was an entrepreneur in her own time.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, that's really cool. Thanks, Angie.
Yeah, thank you.
You can share your story, too, at 816-235-2888. Now let's hear from a local guy who's joining us in studio to tell his story, Darren School. Good morning.
Good morning.
So where is your house and how long have you lived there?
We live on the 40th block of Warwick, and I've owned the home for 10 years. And my wife and I have always been very interested in the history of our home and other homes. And so her birthday was in February this year, and I, well, every year. And for this year, I saw a friend of mine. He put a picture of the 1940 tax assessment photo of his house. And so I asked him about that. I knew they existed. I'd seen them around. I always thought about looking into it. Finally, I did. And then I was hooked.
And you were doing this as part of a birthday present?
Yes, as for a birthday present. Eventually turned into that. I started doing some research, found the Missouri Valley Special Collections Room, and did more research there, found some more photos, and I thought, you know, I could put this all together as a nice visual gift, a framed gift for my wife for showing some of the history of our home.
Okay, I want to get back to the birthday present part of it later, but what... Where did you start your research? How did you begin this process? And I want to hear about the little discoveries along the way.
Okay. Well, at the Missouri Valley room downtown at the library there, they have a lot of resources, the city directories that were mentioned already. I started looking through those. The Sanborn fire insurance maps were very interesting for us because we like to understand the way that our neighborhoods have kind of grown and changed over the years, right?
So what did you learn from those?
The insurance maps, they were done for insurance reasons, and so they showed every building and what they're made of and the square footage, I think, and they were updated at different years. And so you could look at different maps and see when buildings were replaced with other buildings. And for us specifically, there were a couple dozen apartment buildings across the street that were built in between these different iterations of the map. And most of them have since been torn down and turned into a green space for playing fields for kids.
You also learned a lot about the inhabitants, previous inhabitants of your house.
Yeah, we did. And that's the kind of the rabbit hole that never really stops. Just like ancestry work, you can look into this other family and find out a whole lot more about them. And we were lucky enough that the family lived in our house for the first 60 years or so, had an interesting enough life to leave a paper trail through history. The father, his name was William McPike, and he was in the pharmaceutical industry, and he was an early leader west of the Mississippi. And he started in Atchison, Kansas, and left there because he wanted to make more of his elixirs and drugs that used alcohol, and they had strict alcohol regulations. And so he moved his family to Kansas City. I think they actually bought or built our home after he died, but the McPike Drug Company continued on for quite a while. His son ran it. His son-in-law ran it. And it was bought several times, and it's a part of some large company now. I forget the name of
it. This is part of Kansas City's sort of playing fast and loose with the liquor laws?
I don't know. That's something else to research. But the building that he built is downtown on 7th and Central. There's a historical marker there, and it's
for his
still
business.
Standing now. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you've sent some pictures of things that you found, and this bottle of a Peruvian strengthening elixir from the McPike Drug Company is a pretty fascinating thing. I love that you have a photograph of a bottle of the liquor that was made by the guy who lived in the house for the first 60 years. I mean, at that point, it is the history of the house, but it's also kind of not the history of the house anymore.
Yeah, that's the rabbit hole aspect. And we actually have the bottle. My wife found it online. So after I gave her this gift, she went online and found the bottle. I tried to do that because I knew they existed, but she succeeded. She found a man who does this for a living, searching for these old bottles. And he dug it out of a latrine from the 1890s, he thought, in Illinois.
Out of a latrine?
Yes. Well, you know, the outhouse, you're there and trash goes in there too, I guess.
So, okay, what is it exactly that you presented to your wife for her birthday?
Well, it's about a 4-foot wide window frame that came from our house. It's original. We had to have our windows replaced. And I took this window frame and I put a picture of the 1940 tax assessment photo, two pictures of the Sanborn insurance maps on it of our neighborhood, and another one of district number 11, I think, is the map of our area of the city. And the very interesting aspect is that I took her to the gravesite of the family. So there's this large family headstone that says McPike, and then it's got all the kids and the wife there. And I started telling her this story of this family.
And this is how you presented her birthday present? You took her to the cemetery to visit people she's never heard of before?
Yes. I told her it's probably the most interesting thing I'll ever do for her. So I didn't tell her why. I didn't tell her it had anything to do with our house. I spoke for about 15 minutes, giving her the whole history of this family. And then at the end, I said, and this is the family that first lived in our home.
Man, so what is it about your wife that you knew that she would love this birthday present? Because this is not a birthday present for everyone. I would not call it a crowd pleaser.
Well, it may not be
but
a pleaser.
It is
very
thoughtful.
Definitely interesting.
It is very thoughtful for the right person.
Yeah, I agree. Well, she's really interested in ancestry work. She's traced her family back to, I don't know, like the 1400s. We love to go look at old homes and old buildings in every city that we visit. We try to take like even a ghost tour when we're in a new city, because they always kind of tell you the interesting stories of what's happened in you know, the local hotels and banks and homes. So that's something we love to look into.
Does knowing about the people who used to live in your house and about how the block used to be different and about how different materials were used in your part of town over time, does that stuff affect how you live in your house day to day, how you feel about it and relate to it?
I believe so. And I would like that for most people. I mean, you don't have to live in a house or a place that's really old to have history there, unless you're the first ones there or you built it. You know, every home has a history, and I feel like almost like a personality, and you kind of are connected with that home in a way. So much happens in life, even the things that aren't happening within the walls of the home, you know, you're connected with who you are and the family that you're raising there.
We'll hear the stories behind our listeners' houses after this break. Call 816-235-2888 to tell us the history of your house and how you learned it, or the thing you'd really like to know. Our research team might be able to help point you in the right direction. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman, back in a minute. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. We're talking about the history of houses in and around Kansas City. Our guests are Lucinda Adams from the Missouri State Historical Society and Jeremy Druin from the Kansas City Public Library. We've also got Darren School in the studio. He did a lot of research on his house as a present for his wife's birthday. Hi again, everyone.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
So we're going to turn to our callers. We've got Susie with us from Roland Park. Hi, Susie.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good. How about you?
Great. Well, I had a story to tell about our house, which we bought in 2006. It was built in 1917. And so this year it's 100 years old. Yay. we were told by the realtor that the elm tree in the backyard is the oldest tree in Roland Park, and it's absolutely huge and beautiful. And with it being an elm, that makes it, you know, even more rare. But we were also told that the house that we bought was actually a doctor's house. And there is a little tiny house right next to us, and there's a little concrete path between the two houses. The little tiny house was part of the original property. It's been since sold to our friend Jane. But that was his doctor's office. So the doctor lived in our house, and his office was right next door. A couple of years back, they remodeled our local elementary school, and we found out that our street was originally part of the Strang Line. And I was just kind of curious, how would I find out additional history, you know, who the doctor was who lived in our house, if that is indeed true? I've done some homework online, and I found pictures of the house from 1991. But obviously, that's a far cry from 1917. You've got wonderful guests from Missouri, but I was wondering, where in Kansas would I go to find that information about my house?
The Johnson County Museum would be a great resource for you. There's also Kansas State Historical Society.
Susie, I have a couple of questions for you. First of all, I'm not sure if I what you were saying, that it was on the, is it the Strang Line or the Strain Line? What is that?
The Strang Line, which was the trolley line that took, from what I understand, that took folks from Johnson County out south to Olathe. Like, if you go to Olathe, there's the Strang is a street out there.
Right, yeah.
Strange without the E. So apparently, our street was originally called Santa Fe, and right now it's 51st. But they when they redid our elementary school, they found out that, I guess, that street was part of the original Strang Line, which also includes the elementary school. So when they remodeled the school, they made it kind of a trolley theme for the library, which was really nice. But I had no idea that it also had that additional significant, you know, historical, I guess, significance, which makes it interesting because if it's a doctor's office, that makes total sense. If you're on the trolley line, you know, that would be a great place for a doctor to be. I know that we're on, I guess, the city of Roland Park put together a wonderful historical book about the area. And from what I understand, the McDonald's at the end of our street was the property of the Rowe sisters that Rowe Boulevard is named after.
Huh.
There's still a well on that site. But yeah, there's just all these little bits and pieces around town. And I just didn't know. So just the historical society will definitely be a day trip for me this summer then.
Susie, I have just another question for you. When you talk about, like, that your house is about to turn 100 and you say, yay, that seems like an important milestone, not just for the house, but for you. Why?
I just think it's infinitely cool. And just the stories, I really wish the house could talk. I can't imagine, you know, in the middle of the night, somebody, you know, knocking on the door, you know, Dr. Smith or whoever it may have been that lived here, you know, hey, my wife's having a baby, you know, or my child has a fever, or just, I mean, the fact that it's been standing for 100 years to me is impressive in a society where we're always tearing down and rebuilding. There's lots of houses in our neighborhood right now that are being torn down and rebuilt. And it's just like, I don't know. It's fascinating that, first of all, the craftsmanship would have held up. I mean, obviously there's things wrong with it, but, you know, the wood and, you know, the nails were, you know, there was no nail gun. It was done by hand. And it's just absolutely fascinating to me that it's been around for a century. That's just unbelievable.
Thank you so much, Susie.
Thank you.
And Susie's story also, I mean, it's one of these stories where if we knew the answer to exactly whether there was a doctor here and whether this doctor did have an office right next door in the adjacent house, you know, that also tells us something not just about this house, but about medicine at the time. Can you talk about the larger relevance that sometimes can be gleaned from some of these stories?
Well, I think you uncover a lot of these stories when you're researching the history of your house. Darren referenced the rabbit hole, and there's a lot of parallels with genealogy research as well. And I think when people start to research a house or a business, or there's some people that will just see an interesting building in their neighborhood, and they'll just, you know, they don't really have a tie to that building. They just want to research it, and then they'll want to research the inhabitant or what business was there. House history can really lead to a number of different discoveries and stories.
I think it's important what Jeremy said, that it's similar to genealogy. And you do kind of get sucked in to this research and finding out everything that you can. But I think it's important for people to realize, too, that you're going to hit stumbling blocks, and don't stop. You have to keep on going, because there's going to be different avenues for you to find that information.
Let's talk to Lynn in Kansas City. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you? What's your story?
Good, thanks. Well, my mom has a house in Platte County, and it is quite a house. And she was the third owner of the house built in 1865.
Wow.
And, yeah.
People stay there a while.
Yes, absolutely. And it was in the...
I'm sorry. Lynn, we just... Could you repeat your last sentence? We just kind of missed you there.
Yes. So it was in the original family until the mid-1960s. And so my mom was the third owner, and there are many ghosts in that house. And most of our family has experienced at least one or two of the ghosts.
Can you tell us just one little ghost story, and then we'll discuss amongst ourselves?
Yes. So I can tell you... So the first owner, it was built by a family immigrant from Germany, and the woman's name was Grace, and apparently Grace was just this wonderful woman, and people loved to come and visit her, and she had flowers and orchards and all this, and she loved the house, just loved the house, and so she was the first ghost that we saw in the house, and my brother-in-law saw her walking through the house, and she kind of illuminated a blue color, which we later have found out that's like the purest kind of spirit or, you know, entity there is. And she has been seen by other family members, and there's one room in the house, one bedroom, that when you're sleeping at night, if it's a really hot night, she will lift the sheets on the bed by your feet and to kind of billow and cool you off.
Dang.
She's actually even like
that service.
I was sleeping in there one night, and she started like patting my shoulder and, you know, like comforting me, and I thought, I am not going to open my eyes.
Well,
no matter what,
Lynn, that is a wild story. I'm curious from our guests how often people do come in because they have a sense that their house is haunted.
We get several of those, not daily, but, you know, several times a year we'll get people that come in, and usually it doesn't start out that way. When they're doing their house research, they'll just start asking about, people that might have lived there. And then, you know, if there's any information about a murder that might have taken place, we get that quite a bit. And then that normally leads to, more of a paranormal aspect of what's going on in their home. So people aren't really interested in the architecture, not interested in when it was built, but actually interested in the people who live there, if there was any crimes, any strange occurrences. We do see that type of research occasionally.
For some people, I think that's how they get started in it. They hear knocks and scrapes, and for us, sometimes they'll come in and say, I have a little secret room that we've uncovered, or it's been boarded up. So,
you know, you mentioned, Lucinda, that sometimes people will hit stumbling blocks in researching their houses, and that the important thing is to keep going. But can a stumbling block just be final? I mean, in some cases, there really must be a finite amount of information to be had.
Definitely. I think... the advice I will give is to always ask a archivist, librarian, someone, because we're there to help and we want to help. But I do think that sometimes after you've explored all those avenues, there really is just no more information. Sometimes, you know, things weren't saved about these neighborhoods or their houses because people didn't think they were important at the time. So there aren't going to be pictures of your house or drawings or any information out there about them. But I think you can always find out more about the neighborhood. So if you can't find information about your house specifically, find out about the other houses in your neighborhood and what was the community like. There are quite a few neighborhood histories out there for Kansas City, and we're always willing to help people find out more information.
Did you hit some stumbling blocks, Darren? And I'd love to hear how you persevered through them, if so.
Honestly, not really. We have two young kids and life happens. We really want to do more work with it. The library has so many resources available, and just you can do so much just from your own home online, researching genealogy, and the library has so much available electronically as well. One thing I would like to mention for people if they're interested is that one thing that it was really helpful for me was that the library has scanned so much of these large photos and maps into digital format that they can purchase. And so for not a lot, you can get a really high quality scan of really large maps that, you know, you're not going to get a nice reproduction of otherwise. And, you know, pictures of your homes and that sort of thing.
Let's talk to Christopher. Christopher is with us in Overland Park. Hi, Christopher.
Hi. I joined your conversation just a little bit ago, so if I'm off task, let me know. I purchased a building back in the 1980s just off of Hyde Park, and it's an old stable that was built in 1904 with 3.5-foot thick stone walls that were actually mined on site. And Forest used to be a river. We found this out when we saw the plat maps. That has now gone underground and runs right under my building 6 inches under it. And it's beautiful, clear water, and it always runs about 56 degrees. And there was a hand-dug well in it when we started to get the basement excavated. J.C. Lane built it, and he was on the Pendergrass City Council. We chased the lineage of the land all the way back to 1826 when Lewis and Clark came through. And that was quite a feat because you do run into quite a few roadblocks. Things that were very helpful were plat maps just of the region in general showing the geography, as well as the historic room there at Kansas City, Missouri Historic Library. You can trace the history of businesses as well as other things, and this building is just full of history. So I would encourage anyone out there with really interesting buildings to spend the time. It took us about 500 to 1,000 man hours to get it all documented.
Whoa.
In the end, it was really worth it. It's a building that lives today and serves community, so I just wanted to share that with y'all.
Is there a favorite detail that you uncovered that really inspired you or just has enriched your experience of this building?
Well, you know, when working on it, we end up spending several nights in it. It just has this very womb-like feel to it because the stone walls are so thick and the spring that runs underneath the foundation keeps the building nice and cool. So it's just always like walking into this kind of idyllic environment. And on the outside, it has the archways, so it looks like an old fire station, but it was originally a stable that was built to service the trolleys, where there was a trolley table that turned on there at Troost and 33rd and would turn around and go back down Millionaire's Row. So it was mostly the architectural features that brought me to it, because when I moved in there, people thought it was crazy because the area was pretty infiltrated with all kinds of crimes and stuff. And now it's fully integrated and you see young people walking around and jogging, and there's no longer any significant crime in the area. So it's been a real journey. So it's the architecture primarily and the history. It's just, you get real attached to it. You get immersed in it. You become part of it.
Thank you so much, Christopher. You know, I wonder if our guests can talk about people's interest, maybe not necessarily in their own homes, but in the homes of maybe like famous Kansas Cityans. We have someone on Twitter asking if we know anything about Ewing Kaufman's house where he created Marion Labs, for example.
We do see that type of research. People will want to see the various houses, apartments where Charlie Parker lived, or, you know, Robert Altman growing up in Kansas City, or, you know, famous Kansas Cityans. They want to do research on those homes. I guess it makes it feel closer to them, and just you know, to enjoy that piece of history of seeing where a celebrity lived, or maybe, you know, Walt Disney's first studio here in Kansas City. And so we do see a lot of people in doing that type of research.
Lucinda, are there neighborhoods in Kansas City where information is easy to find, and neighborhoods that present particular challenges?
Definitely. You know, the gentleman that just called mentioned Hyde Park, and that's a really good example of a neighborhood where there is going to be more information.
Why?
Because it was at one point a wealthier area, went through a decline, and then came back up. So there's going to be a little bit more information because it was saved. Also, there could have been prominent builders and developers and architects in that area that designed some of the homes. And since they were more prominent, their materials were saved.
So that's gonna determine a lot, I guess. We're going to have to wrap up this conversation, but keep telling us the stories of your houses. You can do that on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. Lucinda Adams, Jeremy Druin, Darren School, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Up next, a blackface vaudeville performer from Kansas by the name of George W. Walker, why an ethnomusicologist is writing his biography. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and now the story of a Kansan who was a big deal in his own lifetime. He's even been called the founding father of the Harlem Renaissance, but he's been largely forgotten by history. His name is George W. Walker, and our guest, Daniel Atkinson, is writing his first ever biography. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Gina. Thank you for having me. This is a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to hear from you. Who was George W. Walker? Like, what are the main things we should know about him to get started?
George W. Walker is the quintessential American. And the quintessential Kansan. He embodies the time period in which he existed. That period between the Civil War and World War I is absolutely fascinating and very much understudied. And he was one of the bright shining stars to come out of that period and basically set up the pace for what we later called the Harlem Renaissance, jazz, rock and roll, and even hip hop.
Even hip hop. I'm going to get back to that. He was a vaudeville performer.
Yes, which was the only choice at the time. And I'd like to add a little caveat. In the introduction, you mentioned that he was a blackface performer. George Walker never really performed in blackface, though.
Oh, wow.
His partner, Burt Williams, did.
Okay, yeah, because my reading was only on the duo for the reasons of there's not a lot on just him.
It's true. And it's partly because his skin was very dark, but also because of his fairly radical views on the minstrel tradition, which he saw as a detriment. So he wanted to create something newer and better, curated black art.
Wow. So he refused to do blackface?
He did. Also, again, it wasn't very necessary. He was very dark, but he was not a blackface performer, no.
So what else do we need to know about him as a performer? Like, you've talked in your writing about the lecture that you're going to give coming up in July, you've talked about that he used shrewd business practices and didn't make compromises. I'm guessing this is one of those areas. What are some others?
He really wanted to maintain a large company of competent performers, pay them well, and set them up to establish their own companies to go further. And when he established an organization called the Frogs in 1908, their goal was to set up theaters, which were early versions of what we now call safe spaces for people who were coming out of the South into the North, into the Midwest, into the larger urban areas, to have space for them to express themselves and develop artistically, especially people who were not going to college or did not feel that they had access to college, because George himself did not receive very much formal education. And that kind of atmosphere that he was trying to create was something that we saw in spades in the 1930s and 40s, particularly in Harlem and Chicago and Philadelphia and Detroit, places like that. But he was trying to do this more than a generation earlier.
What got you interested in his story in particular? How did you learn so much about him to begin with?
Well, as an ethnomusicologist and a specialist in Afro-American music, Burt Williams is one of the first black recording stars ever. And there are 6 biographies on him, so I know quite a bit. And I have a couple of dozen of his recordings from, say, 1900 to about 1922 when he passed.
And he was the other partner in George Walker's duo.
Right. They were a partnership called Williams and Walker, established in around 1893. And Burt is the one whom everybody knows simply because he lived 11 years longer than George, and he also integrated the Ziegfeld Follies after George's passing. And when I was working at the University of Kansas as the assistant director of the Kansas African Studies Center, I just became curious about the history of the local area, especially because Lawrence is such a historically significant place. And also the hometown of Langston Hughes, knowing that George Walker was raised there and was very close with Langston Hughes' mother, I was just naturally curious as to what it was like and to get into his mindset for someone who did so many revolutionary things at a time when those sorts of acts could spell your death in many ways.
Why? I mean, I know that he's not as widely remembered as his partner now, but how was he able to pull those things off? You say they could have spelled his death at the time.
That's something that I'm still trying to figure out. There is some anecdotal information, some information that we still have that are from some of the writings that he left behind in newspapers and magazines and whatnot. Some of it comes from accounts of other performers who lived longer than him, and a few other things where you can sort of triangulate his point of view, but a lot of it came from that revolutionary spirit that he embodied from Lawrence, Kansas, and his unwillingness to settle for less. He was extremely talented and very charismatic, where it was very difficult for people to say no to him, and he had sort of a dogged personality that if a producer or a theater owner or just about anyone was not allowing him access to do whatever it is that he decided that was important for him to do at that moment, he would just sort of attack that problem mercilessly until they would either walk away or relent, or it seems in some cases physically attack him. But he made it so that his troupe, Williams and Walker, operated in first-run theaters and demanded the highest ticket prices, and that was completely unheard of for a black act. I mean, he had the first black production on Broadway in 1902.
So, I mean, these performances took place a really long time ago with obviously just totally different technology for documenting a live show. What kind of documentation exists?
Mostly memoirs from other performers, which are quite rare. And the vast majority of the information comes from newspaper articles, reviews. Black newspapers, particularly the Indianapolis Freeman, the Broad Axe, which came out of Washington, D.C., the Pittsburgh Courier, and the New York Age are absolutely phenomenal. There are a few others, also local Lawrence newspapers, where they were a lot more likely to write about him with candor and in many ways respect or awe, because they didn't really expect him to amount to much. In some of the older articles, they refer to him as a street urchin and things of that nature. No one really expected much out of George Walker, and he was quite a surprise as when he became so successful.
Did you read a review of any like particular show that really, as you read this description, you were like, whoa, this is amazing?
No, not as much. What's particularly interesting to me are some of the writings that he produces, some of the things that he was bold enough to say, because early in their career, because of the prevalence of white performers wearing corks in blackface and performing as blacks, he referred to them as cushion foot coons. And so because that was the term that was used at the time. So he and Burt decided that they were going to differentiate themselves from the cushion foot coons or the fake coons and call themselves the two real coons. And
so it was like, that era. Would you say that in some ways that's sort of I don't know, taking back a derogatory term. We think of that as such a modern phenomenon, but sounds like what they're doing.
It is. He was taking lemons and making lemonade, and which is a term that I use very often because in Dahomey in 1902, the first black production on Broadway is very much the first Lemonade. And so I use that very often because people have no idea who he was and how he did things, because what he did was very inconvenient for the status quo. So as soon as he was not able to defend himself, he was pretty much erased from the record. And I'm trying to rectify that now. And along the way, I'm learning about a whole host of individuals who were equally as remarkable in one way or another, who history has just completely forgotten.
When you say that he was sort of purged from history when he wasn't around to defend himself, how, I mean, can you explain that a little bit more?
Sure. George did not endear himself to the power structure because he would force the issue. He would force them to treat him as equal as he could make them at the time, which made people really angry. So when he was, he became incapacitated around 1909. He contracted syphilis around 1906 or 1907. And by February of 1909, he had become institutionalized. And the writings from that time, particularly from Sylvester Russell from the Indianapolis Freeman, when he's on a train ride going from Kansas to New York, where he ended up dying in Islip. And when they saw him in Chicago, they write of just the complete and utter devastation when people look him in the face and they see that there's nothing behind his eyes. His mind is completely gone. And people were absolutely devastated by that. And it just really shows the power that he had and the confidence that people had in him and what a bright, bright, shining star he was. So after he became incapacitated, the Williams & Walker Company put out one more production in 1909, 1910, called Mr. Load of Coal, in which Bert, his partner, did everything himself. He was the, he became the manager, he became the star, whereas Bert was mostly the comic relief in their duo. George played the straight man and handled all the business. And what happened was Bert ended up negotiating a very poor deal with their producers. Then the producers handled all the purse strings and basically just bled them dry. They refused to pay bills. They refused to buy tickets for train tickets for passage. They refused to even, they would get to the city where they were supposed to be performing and they would not have accommodations. They would not even have a theater in some cases. So they just nickel and dimed them to death, to where Bert fulfilled the contract of 6 weeks and then just killed the production. And that was the end of Williams & Walker. The very next step for him was his manager negotiated a pass for him to integrate the Ziegfeld Follies by giving him honorary whiteness at George's expense. And they basically said that George is a well-read, Bert is a well-read man. He's well-behaved, and any discomfort that anyone felt because of Williams & Walker was George's fault. George didn't know his place, but Bert does.
Wow.
And Bert went into the Ziegfeld Follies, and he stayed there until he passed in 1922. In other words, he became the fly in the ointment.
So when we think about George Walker specifically, not just the duo that ends up being sort of whitewashed, I guess, for lack of a better word. I mean, does George W. Walker have his own important legacy? You mentioned connections to hip hop.
Yes, because George really believed in the beauty that could be created by black artists and black arts in general. Painting, sculpting, music, comedy, theater, all of those things. His protege was James Rhys Europe, who was the man who introduced jazz to Europe during World War I. He was also a member of the Frogs, the fraternal organization that he established with Bert Williams, with another guy named Cecil Mack, who established the first black publishing company, with J. Rosamond Johnson of the Johnson Brothers, an absolutely fantastic man who was largely understudied. And I'm just glad to be a part of this. And I want more young scholars to dig into this information so that we have this wealth of knowledge to draw from.
Well, our time is up. Daniel Atkinson, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Daniel is giving a talk at the National African American Quilt Convention in July. It'll be at venues throughout Lawrence, July 12th through 15th. Daniel is an ethnomusicologist living in Washington State, and he used to run the Kansas African Studies Center at KU. You can listen back to the show at kcur.org/centralstandard. We talked about George W. Walker, but also the history of Kansas City houses. Tomorrow, the challenges rural communities are facing when it comes to education. If you have an experience or perspective we need to consider as we explore that, please join the conversation. We'll want to hear from you tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. Our intern is Danielle Hogarty. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.